Thanks for listening to Here and Now. Help us shape the future of the program and public radio as a whole. NPR wants your feedback and observations to enrich our news coverage and storytelling. At nprlistens.org, you can join the conversation. Voice your opinions. Make an impact. Visit nprlistens.org.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Britain raised its terror threat level to severe, meaning an attack is highly likely, because of fears that hundreds of British citizens fighting in Iraq and Syria with Islamic militants will return home. Here's Prime Minister David Cameron today.
Britain is an open, tolerant, and free nation. But we cannot stand by and allow our openness to be confused with the tolerance of extremism.
Well, in a few minutes, we're going to speak with NPR's Dina Temple-Raston about the U.S. citizens fighting overseas.
But first, to another reminder of just how vicious ISIS is. The group has released a new video showing the beheading of what it says is a Kurdish man. The video was titled, "A Message in Blood," and the man killed was wearing the same sort of orange jumpsuit that U.S. journalist James Foley had on when he was beheaded. Mohammed Yahia is the BBC's Arabic editor. He joins us from London. And Mohammed, could you give us a sense of what you're seeing from ISIS and whether, in your view, ISIS is escalating its violence?
Well, the video that you referred to looked like it was a sort of a psychological warfare against the Peshmerga Kurdish fighters who are facing the Islamic State group in Iraq. They paraded a group of soldiers who they said they captured, and they forced them to read out a message calling on their government in Erbil to stop fighting the Islamic State and to cut off its cooperation with the United States. And then they showed this video of the killing, decapitating of one of the soldiers.
There's another video that shows ISIS militants running captured Syrian soldiers across the desert, and those soldiers were later killed, and dozens of them were there lying in a mass grave. As you've said, this is clearly a message aimed at people in the region. Do you also think there's a message being sent to the West?
What the Islamic State group is doing is, after they have captured these vast areas across Syria and Iraq, the priority for them now is to consolidate their positions there. And they have been following a pattern of, once they capture an area, they start to intimidate the local population, to force them to be completely quiet and subordinate. They kick out all non-Sunnis, and then they start, you know, showing these kinds of videos to sort of scare anybody from trying to revolt against them or attack them from outside.
We're reading today that James Foley and at least three other hostages were waterboarded early in their captivity, and that has echoes of the waterboarding of CIA detainees when they were held in secret CIA prisons. I'm wondering if what your thoughts on that are. Is there intended to be a parallel there?
Well, if you add this to the orange jumpsuits, which is very similar to the orange jumpsuits that were worn by the Guantanamo Bay detainees, you get a sense of the mindset of the group and how, you know, vindictive they are, bitter about the United States, and especially now that they started to be attacked inside Iraq. And there is a possibility that, I mean, now there is a possibility of attacks being launched inside Syria as well. So there is this sort of standoff and vindictive mindset.
Mohammed, in terms of the U.S. response to this, President Obama met with his security team yesterday to talk about strategy, and he was asked by reporters if ISIS can be defeated without the U.S. taking military action in Syria. Here's part of his answer.
In order for us to degrade ISIL over the long term, we're going to have to build a regional strategy. Now, we're not going to do that alone. We're going to have to do that with other partners, in particularly Sunni partners, because part of the goal here is to make sure that Sunnis, both in Syria and in Iraq, feel as if they've got an investment in a government that actually functions.
Mohammed, what do you think the Islamic State thinks when it hears that?
Well, the press conference that Obama gave yesterday, he was asked about the possible attacks on ISIL or ISIS inside Syria. And he actually poured some water on that, saying that it's not imminent. The strategy is still being drawn out. and that for the time being, the United States will concentrate on protecting Americans in Erbil and in Baghdad and picking opportunity targets as they have been doing over the past 2 weeks in Iraq. But he didn't rule out eventually a campaign against the ISIS. And he pointed out to this regional Sunni coalition. He said that he's going to send John Kerry to the region. And also the United States has been talking to partners in Europe, Australia, about, you know, a coordinated campaign. So when ISIS look at all of this, they see that something is coming. There is the whole picture is building up towards a confrontation that may involve Sunni countries, that may involve armed groups inside Syria and Iraq, local Sunni armed groups. The build-up is for a confrontation and for an escalation. And they are preparing themselves for that, using everything within their means in terms of digging in, preparing their defenses, intimidating their enemies in preparation for this possible showdown.
Mohammed Yahia is the BBC's Arabic editor. He's been speaking to us from London. Mohammed, thank you.
You're welcome.
And as we mentioned earlier, Britain has raised its terrorism threat level from substantial to severe because of ISIS or the Islamic State. It's believed that at least 500 people have traveled from Britain to fight for Islamic militants in Syria and Iraq. So how many have traveled from the U.S.? And why are they going? This week alone, we heard of two who died. Also this week, NPR's counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Raston has been reporting on Americans traveling overseas to fight with militant groups. Her research shows that the number has more than doubled since January and is now more than 140. Dina joins us from the NPR studios in Washington. And Dina, start with that basic question. What did you find? Why are Americans going?
Well, I think we need to start by making a distinction that not all the groups that are fighting in the region in Iraq and Syria are necessarily extremist. There are some secular, very nationalist groups like the Free Syrian Army, which is the one the U.S. is looking to support. And some of the Americans appear to be joining those more nationalist, secular groups. Mm-hmm. As I said in the stories this week, you know, as the battle is ground on, more of these extremist and Islamist groups are popping up. And so they're sort of encapsulating some of these Americans who are coming.
Well, that's tough. I mean, that's the tough part of all the decision making the White House is in the middle of right now. You know, who do you support? So you're saying some Americans are going to support groups that are more nationalist and initially the U.S. was supporting in Syria in particular. But let's talk about one that you reported on this week in your series, Eric Haroun. He crossed into Syria last year in early 2013. Here's a bit of a video he posted on his Facebook page while he was there.
Bashar al-Assad, your days are numbered. You're going down in flames. You should just quit now while you can and leave. You're going to die no matter what. Where you go, we will find you and kill you.
So, Dina, tell us more about Eric Haroun. Who's he and what happened to him?
Well, he was a former private in the U.S. Army, and he'd never been stationed overseas but had a car accident while he was on duty here in the U.S., and it was bad enough that he needed to get a metal plate put in his head, and then he was discharged. So he was a former private in the Army. So he wanted people to think he was born Muslim, but in fact, he wasn't. He was a convert, and he wasn't particularly religious. What he was is he was sort of what we call in the story a war tourist. I mean, he went to Egypt and was there during a lot of the uprising for Tahrir Square, and he saw what was going on in Syria, and he wanted to witness that too. So he thought he would actually see a revolution that would topple the Syrian government. So he started out fighting with the Free Syrian Army, one of these more nationalist groups. And the problem with Syria and Iraq is in these battles that you have maybe a secular group fighting Assad right next to another group that might be an al-Qaeda affiliate. Mm. And that's what happened to him. So he ended up getting swept up. He said he thought he was in a group called Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda's arm in Syria. It turns out that wasn't exactly right, but that's where he thought he was.
Well, and he was arrested when he returned to the U.S. Is going to fight alongside militants explicitly illegal?
Well, there's some gray area here, certainly. You know, also the gray area for counterterrorism officials is, you know, before when people went to go and fight with al-Qaeda or went to go and join al-Qaeda, there wasn't a lot of gray area as to whether or not they had joined a terrorist group. The problem with Syria is that a lot of regular Muslims are going to Syria because they feel it's their duty, that Assad is a bad man, that he is killing women and children. And as a good Muslim, not as an extremist Muslim, not as an anti-American Muslim, but just as a good Muslim, you feel you need to go there and lend a hand.
Well, some of them, you point out, might have been prompted back when we did see Assad gassing women and children. And you say some American Muslims are comparing this to the Spanish Civil War, when it was perfectly fine for some people to go off and fight against what they saw were atrocities.
Well, I'm not sure that Muslims are saying it's like
No, they're not. You were.
But yeah. to them, you know, in the same way that you... There's enough bad things that people are seeing on the internet about what's going on to Assad to drive someone who feels that they ought to lend a hand to drive them there. Some people are going to work in hospitals. Some people are actually working in refugee camps. And some make their way across the border, maybe fight for a month, and then come out.
Yeah. Well, one of the last questions you tackled in your series is whether ISIS is looking to attack the U.S., as some fear. You spoke with Audrey Kurth Cronin, a professor at George Mason University and expert on terrorism. Let's listen to a little of what she said.
To some extent, ISIS's next moves depend upon how we react. And if we're talking about what an enormous threat they are and lionizing them, that ultimately, even if unintentionally, helps them.
And Dina Temple-Rassin, your thoughts on that? You know, if two-pronged, if people are going because there are some Americans who feel that they have to defend, let's say, other Muslim women and children in Syria, that may be not a fight they're taking back here to the U.S. But then we're hearing that maybe ISIS gets, as she said, lionized and something changes.
Right. And remember, they have territory in Iraq and Syria. And some people are attracted to the thought that they might actually be living in a Muslim homeland, in a caliphate, something that al-Qaeda had been promising to do, but never really was able to do. So there's a lot of gray area here, which is what we were trying to say in the story, that it's very hard to tell who's a threat and who isn't. And when they go into Syria, the intelligence there for the U.S. is so awful that they really don't know who's fighting with who and who, when they come back, are the ones who have finished their what they consider to be their Muslim duty and the ones who have come back with something else completely in mind.
A new agenda. NPR's counterterrorism correspondent Dina Temple-Rassin. We'll link you to all her terrific reporting this week. Dina, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
Complicated subject with gray areas. You're listening to Here and Now. Today, Malaysia Airlines announced it would lay off 6,000 workers and pare back its global network of flights as the company tries to recover from what we know is an understatement, a difficult year. Two of its airliners crashed, one, of course, yet to be found in the southern Indian Ocean, the other shot down by a missile in eastern Ukraine. But will this nearly $2 billion restructuring be enough to save the airline? Here now is Peter O'Dowd is with us for more. And Peter, just how much has these recent crashes been a part of the airline's trouble?
There's no doubt it has something to do with it, perhaps a big part of it. The airline acknowledged just how difficult this year has been. The reputation has really taken a hit. After the first crash, passenger loads really fell. Planes were about 68% full after that. Airline officials said, you know, conditions started to improve. They were starting to see signs of growth again. But then Ukraine happened. And so this is certainly a problem here. You've seen pictures that passengers have taken on these airplanes, just row after row of empty seats. Employee morale also very low.
Well, but the airline's trouble goes even further than what's happened this past year.
It's important to remember that. One of the airline's directors said that these cuts were a result of a perfect storm. For years now, the airline has struggled with inefficiencies. It's been a big legacy airline. And that's what Robert Mann told me today. He's an airline analyst. He says the airline's losing $1 million a day. If you look at it this way, a competitive airline, Mann says, is going to have about 110 employees per aircraft. But Malaysia Airlines is more like 170 employees per aircraft.
Oh, so not well managed.
No, maybe. I mean, it's expensive. Plus, he says it comes down to the types of planes that the airline is using.
The fleet is a very large gauge fleet, meaning many seats per individual aircraft, A380s, 777s, 747s. it's a large average aircraft size for the mission, and that often means that you have to fill up with very, very low fare business.
And that brings up another important point here. The part of the world where Malaysia Airlines is flying is just full of these burgeoning low-cost carriers, and Mann says that those airlines are growing faster than in any other part of the globe. So this big legacy airliner, Malaysia Airlines, has these big, comfortable planes, then they really just kind of need to rethink what they're doing in a way.
And so how do you think that'll play out? What is next for the company?
Well, even airline officials said that success is not a guarantee. The company is majority owned by the government. It's headed towards being entirely state-run because the airline's going to be delisted from the Malaysian Stock Exchange quite soon. But fundamentally, the question is going to be, can the leadership pare down the airline to make it more efficient than it is right now?
Well, meanwhile, Peter, it's been almost 6 months. Anything new on missing Malaysia Airlines Flight 370?
Yeah, it's been incredible. The mystery continues. There's been new information out just recently that shows information from satellite phones means the plane may be further south than originally thought. Underwater missions will be resuming here in just a couple weeks.
Here now is Peter O'Dowd with the latest on Malaysia Airlines, which has announced it's cutting back on workers and flights. Peter, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
So we'll follow that story. But meanwhile, turning from airlines to apps, there is a new one on the market to help transgender people learn how to adjust their voices as they transition from one gender to another. It's not as simple as speaking lower as a man or higher as a woman. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, WBUR's Martha Biebinger has more.
41-year-old Lorelei Arisis began the medical transition from male to female 8 years ago. Arisis almost always wears a dress, and she keeps her hair long to offset features that are difficult or impossible to change, like her height, 6'4", and her voice.
I get slurred on the phone way more than I do in person. Voice can be a real liability. There are definitely large parts of this country, even this state, where it's dangerous to be trans. It can be a matter of life or death.
So Arisis is testing a transgender voice mobile app called Eva. It comes with breathing and speaking exercises to help people raise or lower their pitch.
So there's this button that says listen to pitch. He 75% my pitch was too low, so it's got a...
Arisis tries again, this time switching to her preferred pronoun.
She... Hey, that was 99%. It's hilarious that she brought me to 99%.
Some transgender women have surgery to shorten their vocal cords and help them speak in a higher range. Arisis has decided surgery is too risky because the results aren't predictable. But doing nothing can be emotionally debilitating.
Many of the people that I work with will not go out into public because they have to talk.
That's Kathy Perez. She's a Denver-based speech-language pathologist who developed the transgender voice app.
Or they'll go with people so that the wife or the friend will order for them at a restaurant because they're afraid to open their mouths because the sound that comes out doesn't match the person that's sitting at that table.
Perez says it takes 6 months to a year of daily practice to permanently adjust one's voice.
It's extremely difficult to override some of the early programming we have in our brains about how we express ourselves. So we retrain the voice by retraining the brain. They go together.
That retraining goes beyond pitch, says Celia Hooper. She's worked with transgender adults on voice, inflection, and speech patterns since 1978.
Let's say if I wanted to be a male, yep, nope, talk, whoop, just like that.
Whereas women practice a more flowery speech.
Saying things like, oh, it's just fabulous, that's just marvelous. One group that I led, we always did the Southern bless your heart, you know, but not many people do that.
Hooper, now a dean at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro, says authentic speech is paired with gestures and other body language that is sometimes distinctly masculine or feminine. She's had clients watch soap operas, first with a sound up and then off.
Soap operas are full of people who are either hyper-female or hyper-male, so you can get an idea of their behavior and then kind of reel it in because gender expression is on a continuum.
A continuum with implications, says Lorelei Arises.
If I kind of use a more submissive tone and a more questioning tone, people will be more likely to gender me as female. And on the flip side, if I make statements, if I'm clear about what I'm saying, if I'm bold, people will very often be more likely to gender me as male.
So Arises chooses, from one conversation to the next, whether she wants to be seen as female and perhaps taken less seriously, or seen as male.
And I have to make those little decisions every day, often several times a day.
Many transgender men and women say voice is a powerful part of their emotional well-being. It is a window into our character, said poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
How wonderful is the human voice!
It is indeed the organ of the soul.
Voice is also the way we decide, often instantaneously, whether we are listening to a man or a woman.
But the soul reveals itself in the voice only, as God revealed him.
The soul of man is audible, not visible.
A sound alone betrays the flowing of the eternal fountain, invisible to man.
For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger.
The organ of the soul. You're listening to Here and Now.
And here's something I learned just today. The Tug of War World Championships is taking place in Madison, Wisconsin this weekend. Listen to that exertion. This afternoon's competition is being live streamed. Teams from Switzerland, Ireland, Nigeria, South Africa, and Taiwan are competing. And joining us from his home in Wisconsin is Rick Skindrude, who helps coach the U.S. team from Wisconsin. Rick, I have not played tug of war since I was a kid. So remind us, is there always a mud pit in the middle?
At this level, there is never a mud pit in the middle.
Really?
Never. The rope has a center mark on it. And then on each side of that center mark, there is another mark at, 4 meters or approximately 12 feet. And you have to pull it 12 feet to win.
Ah. Is this all about brute strength, big biceps?
Oh, absolutely not. Strength is obviously an important part of it. But it's the timing. It is the ability to have foot position. They dig in their heels, and it's knowing at what position and how low you can get to and still maintain your balance and coordination to pull on the rope. And of course, the weakest part of your whole system in this pulling is your forearms.
Oh.
You will lose your grip on the rope because we actually try to pull pretty much straight armed, and so you don't use the bicep muscle.
Rick, I've read that you call tug of war a thing of beauty when it's done right. What does a beautiful tug of war game look like?
Well, it's 8 guys just absolutely in synchronization. It's they are all leaning back at the proper angle. The rope is perfectly straight from back to front. Watching a good team, it is a thing of beauty.
What about when a team loses? Do you ever see one whole side just go collapsing to the ground? And is that kind of the opposite of a thing of beauty?
Not at the world championship level. They do not collapse to the ground. What will happen is they may lose their footing and land on their rear end because they're so low and just get dragged right across for the 12 foot. These guys are in top physical shape.
And these are not particularly young guys in some cases.
Oh, absolutely not. A lot of these guys, I think that our oldest puller is just short of 60 years old.
Oh, is that right?
And a lot of these are in their late 40s, early 50s.
Rick, rope and flesh can be a bad combination. So I imagine this is a game that can have some gory injuries if it's played the wrong way.
Over the years, before we got so competitive, when we used to be more of what we called the bar teams years ago.
The bar teams? Ones that kind of meet at the local pub and get together?
Yeah, we'd get together and pull for a half barrel of beer. You know, this is how it got started many years ago. And the worst injury I ever seen was a fellow dislocated his knee one time. But the injuries that happen now on our rope, these guys' hands are so tough What will happen is sometimes if the other team gives a big jerk on the rope or they aren't prepared or they aren't doing it properly, I have, you know, seen calluses ripped off of their hands, you know, that, and that's, it's painful. It's not life-threatening in any imagine, but it hurts like the Dickens, and, you know, they got to shake it off and grab hold of the rope and go again.
Rick Skindrud is a tug-of-war enthusiast and coach. He joined us from Wisconsin, where the tug-of-war World Championships are taking place this weekend. Rick, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
As the school year ramps up, we wanted to take a look at the shift towards paperless classrooms. Google is one company trying to create classrooms without pencils or notebooks or excuses about dogs eating homework. Google's web-based software, Google Apps for Education, already has about 30 million active users around the world. Many teachers say it's a helpful time saver and lets them see how students are doing on assignments as they're working on them. But others worry about commercializing the classroom, about student privacy, and about whether this is just another passing technological fad. NPR Ed's lead blogger, Anya Kamenetz, has been writing about Google in the classroom and is here to tell us more. Hi, Anya.
Hi.
And you've been speaking to teachers in paperless classrooms, as Google calls them. Would you explain how they work?
Sure. Well, anybody who works in a modern-day office can probably get a sense of this. Basically, the idea is that assignments are online, that students can ask questions online, that students are creating assignments using programs like Google Docs or drawing programs and submitting them automatically. And then teachers are also providing feedback through email or through a web interface.
I noticed in your blog post about this that you mentioned that teachers could even provide feedback as a student is working on an assignment because the teacher could kind of be figuratively looking over their shoulder online as they do it. And I was trying to decide if that felt odd to me or whether it's the same as a student going to a teacher mid-assignment and saying, I need your help.
I think that we've got to develop cultures and understandings around this idea that a student understands that a teacher is able to see their work. For the teachers that I talked to, they really saw it as a boon because, for example, you assign a group project and they come in and give their presentation and you really don't know who's doing what. But this teacher said, you know, these students created a Google Doc together and I could glance at their revision history and I could see exactly how much time each student had spent on it. And so it gives her some transparency into the classroom process that wasn't available before this technology.
What else do teachers and students see as the benefits of this?
Well, efficiency, obviously, you know, being able to instantly create a copy of assignments and give them to students, students being able to turn things in with one click. Like you said, it gets rid of the dog ate my homework problem. and with the new Google Classroom, they're really offering the opportunity to grade things like using Google Forms. You can do automatic grading just like you would scoring a survey or a quiz. And give that right back to students. So, you know, the company is promising that it saves time. Teachers are saying that it updates the way that they teach.
Now, this is all Wi-Fi dependent, I assume, some way to connect to the internet. What if that goes down? Does the whole school system seize up?
Well, that's a really important question. You know, a 2013 survey found that 57% of school districts lack the adequate Wi-Fi to actually support a one-to-one device program. And so by switching over to web-based software and cloud-based services, you really are making a big assumption that you're going to have the infrastructure to support it. And that's just not the case in too many places around the country.
And is the same issue true at home, that some students may not be connected at home and so they're limited in terms of their ability to do online homework and that sort of thing?
Very much so. You know, one of the teachers I spoke to was in the Central Valley in California, and she said a lot of her students don't have Wi-Fi at home. She had to make sure that every assignment that she gave had a written or printed out equivalent. And that really changes the nature of the challenge here when you're talking about the digital divide at home as well as at school.
Anya, this is free software from Google?
Right. So Google Apps in general are free to use.
Is there any cost to schools of adopting this technology?
I mean, it depends how you look at it. Of course, there are infrastructure costs and device costs. So Google also is involved in the production of the Chromebook, which is a low-cost, stripped-down laptop. And so, of course, they have some, I think, hope that, you know, the sales of that hardware are going to complement or be bundled with the use of this free software.
Right. And I assume that Google is not developing all this educational technology just out of benevolence. So what else does Google potentially get out of this?
Well, it's interesting. I spoke to a student privacy expert who kind of had the great line that said, you know, if you're using free software and you're not sure what they're selling, you are the product. Mm. And the question becomes then for students, how is that use then going to be monetized? One way possibly is through creating, you know, faithful Google users down the line. Are they going to be, you know, familiar with Google applications and want to continue to use them? And then the other issue has to do with, you know, scanning of email and privacy and commercialization.
And on this issue of privacy concern, Google has admitted that it had been data mining student email messages to potentially improve its targeted advertising. So whose job is it and to protect the privacy of students online, and how should it be protected?
Well, so as of late April, because of the discovery process of this lawsuit, Google says that they're no longer scanning any student information from Gmail or any other Google app for education. So, you know, they voluntarily dropped it, but the point still really stands. And the question is, you know, how are we going to protect student information if schools, you know, obviously have this need for technological resources and they don't want to spend a lot of money for it, but they are certainly exposing themselves to terms of service, and terms of service can always change.
Anya, you know, I know, we all know how quickly things can change in technology. So what happens if this gets phased out? I wonder if you talk to any teachers who worry about losing technical support or maybe having to keep chasing the latest educational technology trends if this one goes away and a new one pops up.
You know, I'm increasingly interested in the way that new technologies create a huge human burden. I mean, beyond the cost of technology, even if it's free, the real cost is in professional development. It's in training teachers and getting them up to speed. And, you know, the fact that this is going to be a constant process, that every few years there's going to be something new coming down the pike, I think it's giving a lot of teachers some hesitation.
You referenced this, but for years we've all been hearing about how one day offices will be paperless. But at least in the office where I work, we still use and print a lot of paper. So how likely is it that classrooms really will be so heavily digital one day that quizzes and tests and homework will mostly happen online?
You know, I think that day may be coming a little bit faster than we think. With the phase-in of the Common Core state standards and those aligned tests, they're all being given on computers. And so there's a lot more schools and a lot more places where students are getting used to the experience of taking tests online. And I think following along from that is going to be much more appreciation and understanding that the classroom needs to resemble the modern workplace in a lot more ways.
Anya Kamenetz is the lead blogger for NPR Ed. Anya, thank you.
Thank you, Sasha.
And on Fridays, we go on stage. I'll look at what's happening on the boards across the country, from dinner theater to poetry slams to outdoor stage festivals.
When you help me, you know you help me so well.
That was Calvin Harris featuring Florence Welch at the Made in America Music Festival in Philadelphia. Before that, we heard Matthew Shipp on piano at the Chicago Jazz Festival. And to start, Geneva Magnus at the Bayfront Blues Festival in Duluth, Minnesota. And this weekend, Southern Decadence in New Orleans. It's also known as the Gay Mardi Gras, as one participant put it in the Times-Picayune. It's a chance to celebrate the end of a summer and to wear a dress. This is the 43rd Southern Decadence. Chuck Robinson has been involved for the last decade or so. He's owner of Napoleon's Itch, a gay bar on Bourbon Street that hosts a slice of the weekend that's on stage, the free outdoor Bourbon Street Extravaganza on Saturday. He joins us from WWNO in New Orleans. And Chuck, the stage concerts are free because you say there's a good reason.
Well, the reason for that is the figures from our city government are we had 160,000 people fly in last year to celebrate the LGBT lifestyle in our wonderful city of New Orleans, and it produced, these are actual figures from City Hall, not Chuck Robinson's, $160 million in revenues,
wow,
which is taxable in revenues to the city. Hotels, restaurants, retails, bars, that is over one-sixth of our city's total operating budget.
Let's listen to a little bit of the music that they're going to hear. R&B artist Jeannie Tracy will be singing. Here's her song. A lot of people know it, Party People. Jeannie Tracy there is going to be singing this Saturday. And by the way, we'll let our listeners know, you can see pictures of the festival online. There's a float parade, drag parade. There's also a lot of nudity. There's going to be a famous German porn star there this weekend. This is not necessarily a family event.
I would like to make a comment to that. 11 years ago when we started, the Archdiocese and the Archbishop was quite public with our wonderful religious community saying that Southern decadence was a naughty thing and perhaps it needed to be shut down. So I went on television live in New Orleans 11 years ago and explained that what we were doing was not only free, but we were producing a legitimate live concert with stars, and we were entertaining the public, and in no way would it be off color, and that remains our mission.
Well, just we have to comment. You mentioned the early religious objections. One minister, Grant Storms, was an outspoken critic of the festival. He didn't think New Orleans should host it. He was later arrested on obscenity charges, and he apologized to the festival.
Yes, and I may speak frankly, because it's truth and it's public information, that he was caught in La Frenier Park in a compromising situation in the view of children. He has since been defamed, and it was hypocritical. I was quite outspoken about this when this all happened. So
there's a lot swirling around this event, but your hope on Saturday is just to have some fun. And country singer-songwriter Waylon Payne will be another one of the performers. Let's listen to a little of his I Love You. And I went away taking all the blame because I love you. To this day, you can't say my name, but I love you. Well, the festival itself, the broader festival, was started by a group of men, we understand, back in the 1970s. Outside the French Quarter, they didn't have a lot of money, but there was a big bathroom where we're reading with a couch. We're getting all this from the Southern Decadence website. As one person bathed, others would sit on the couch and read A Streetcar Named Desire out loud.
Absolutely.
From those beginnings, we have this huge event.
It was actually a going-away party for Michael Evers in 1972. 2 years later, we added the Grand Marshals, which has been a tradition ever since.
Well, another performer Saturday, the Dolly Parton tribute artist Sandy Anderson. Let's listen. Working 9 to 5, what a way to make a living. So there's Sandy Anderson, Dolly Parton tribute artist. We understand other tribute artists will be around town. But we just have to ask you, this was all canceled in 2005 because of Hurricane Katrina. And you know, it is being held right in hurricane season. There's one off the coast. You worried?
Not at all. It's city business always calls me in the media to say, Chuck, what you going to do? 2005, of course, was devastating. We had to evacuate the city, as you know. Jeannie Tracy has been with us all for the 10 years. She arrived in Boas in 2005, and we left with machine guns, the same she did for the next Gustav. So we've had two shows canceled by Katrina and Gustav. And then we had a tropical storm where Jeannie hovered with a downpour rain in Napoleon's Itch with the doors wide open with people gathered around. That's the way it happens. Worried? Of course. We have 60% chance of rain. There is no hurricane for us. I think, unfortunately, the East Coast and Texas is going to get a little bit of it. We have tents, etc., to cover the sound, and we'll delay the show till it lets up. Mm-hmm. We're in New Orleans. Rain never hurt anybody. We're surrounded by water.
Well, and what's the mood? What happens? You say all these thousands of people fly in. What does it feel like in the city?
It is incredible. They began arriving last night. The hotels fill up. They come from all over the world. This is just not a United States view. Our people, our clients from Australia, England, France, Germany, South America, Central America, with what our city has to offer. And let's face it, unique is the city of New Orleans and the French Quarter. It's only 10 by 12 blocks. And in that 10 by 12 blocks, there's a freedom, and it's almost a Walter Mitty mentality where I can be who I really want to be here, you know? And that doesn't mean be naughty. It means You can carry a drink from bar to bar. The bars never close. There's music. There's great food. We're very unique. And as we all know, we're the second most visited city in America right after San Francisco. I think we'll beat them.
This is a lot of fun. A lot of fun for people who come in. But is it also important for you, the community that lives there and puts it on?
Number one, of course, it produces revenues for their businesses. The other thing is, it's important not to flaunt, but I know the mentality of the community that I serve and I'm a part of it. We are proud to be proud. We're not defiant. We're truly out of to celebrate the ability to be free. Join hands in the street, and when I kick on, love is in the air at the end, and we throw napkins, that's the message. Love is in the air. Let's have fun. Let's all make money. Let's smile, and let's walk away with, we love New Orleans. We'll be back.
That's Chuck Robinson, owner of Napoleon's Itch, a gay bar on Bourbon Street that hosts the Bourbon Street Extravaganza on Saturday, and we'll have links to everything you need to know at hereandnow.org. Chuck, have a blast.
Why don't you come on down? I got a VIP pass for you.
Well, it's awfully tempting. Thank you.
All right. My cell phone's available.
Love is in the air. Everywhere I look around.
And Sasha, everyone here just yelled at me. I want that VIP pass. We're listening to John Paul Young's Love is in the Air. It's something of an anthem at the festival this weekend in New Orleans. What are you doing on stage? Let us know at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Here and Now.
And it's there when I'm looking your eyes. Love is in the air.